Mr. Franker? Ms. Francer. Franker? Okay, Franker. Now we'll see what it really is.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jocelyn Francor, or Francor, as my father may prefer. And together with Jeff Stone, I represent Felix Vasquez Ruiz in this matter. When Juror Diaz, on the day that Mr. Vasquez Ruiz testified, and Juror Diaz being the only Hispanic member of the jury, found in her juror notebook the word guilty written in capital letters, the district court was faced with three issues. It was faced with a premature determination regarding Mr. Vasquez Ruiz's guilt, it was faced with the potential of juror intimidation, and it was faced with a suggestion of juror bias. Faced with all three of those issues, the district court had an obligation to conduct a thorough investigation and to ensure that Mr. Vasquez Ruiz's right, constitutional right, to an impartial jury.
What do you think the judge should have done?
I think that the judge could have done a few things, but I think one of the easiest things that the judge could have done, and that in a cost-benefit analysis would have required little additional inquiry at great benefit, would be at least to question the two jurors that the judge identified as having similar handwriting in his review of the handwriting that had been presented in the voir dire questionnaires. And perhaps starting from that position, that may have answered the critical questions before the court. And those questions were not questions that Juror Diaz could answer, the only juror who the district court questioned. Juror Diaz could not answer who wrote the note. She could not answer why that person wrote the note. And she could not answer whether other jurors shared the sentiments of the note's writer.
You said that the judge thought he was prohibited from questioning a juror, because that would be ridiculous, and he did question her. So he didn't really mean that, did he?
I think
when he said, "I don't think I can do that. I don't think I can start questioning jurors in the middle of a trial," didn't he really mean that he didn't? He thought it would be inappropriate.
Well, I think all we can look at is the transcript, which is precisely what Your Honor has just identified. And Judge Cannelli twice indicated that he did not believe he could question jurors. And the precise quote is on page 1032 of the trial transcript, where he says, "I don't think I can do that," precisely what you just said. "I don't think I can start questioning jurors in the middle of a trial."
He questioned one, right?
Pardon me?
He did question one.
He responded to Juror Diaz's note, absolutely. But to the extent, I mean, I'd like to point out in particular that the district court doesn't say, "I don't want to. I think it would be intrusive. I think it would be a problem."
What if he'd interviewed the two jurors with a suspicious handwriting and they just denied anything? What would the next step be?
I think to the extent that they denied anything and those answers to those critical questions remained unanswered, to the extent that there was no identification of who wrote that note, then investigation would have to proceed until the court could be satisfied.
What do you mean, investigation?
I think that additional voir dire may have been necessary of other jurors in order to confirm that Mr. Vasquez's right to an impartial jury was protected. I think that it was critical that the court get the answers to those questions.
I think you should just argue there should have been a mistrial. I don't understand this business of having an inquisitorial investigation of all 12 jurors.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, defense counsel moved for a mistrial, and we're arguing that the denial of that mistrial constituted an abuse of discretion. But in a case, for instance, in United States versus McClinton, where the court was similarly presented with allegations of juror bias, and in that case, defense counsel moved for a mistrial, and Judge Crabb then went ahead and conducted an individual voir dire of the jurors in response to that motion in an attempt to make an assessment that would permit the case to go forward, which I believe was in a later stage of trial, as this case was. So I believe that it's absolutely correct that the denial of the motion for a mistrial is the error here. But the thorough investigation that the district court could have conducted could have corrected that error at the time with very little.
I don't see that. I don't really see that. Suppose he questions the other 11, and they all deny having written Then what does he do?
Well, I think at that point, Your Honor, to the
someone's lying.
To the extent that they deny having written the note, I think that that presents a very different situation than what we have here, because at that point, had the district court in fact interrogated individual members of the jury, he could have conducted a credibility and demeanor assessment.
That's ridiculous.
Well, I think to the extent that the court just gave a curative instruction as it...
Look, if 11 of them say no, one is lying. Unless you buy this, you know, the cleaning person wrote it, which is, or the previous juror from a previous case.
Yes, we do not, Your Honor.
Really unlikely. So then you'd have 11 people. You're not going to figure out who's lying.
Well, I think the difficulty here is that we don't...
The one who's sweating, the one who's in...
We absolutely don't know what those jurors would have said upon additional interrogation. But at least it would have permitted the court to make the credibility determination that that appellate courts rely on when deferring to a district court's judgment.
The choice is a mistrial or just forget it. Now, it was the trial was 9 days old or something?
The penultimate day of trial when the note was discovered and Juror Diaz brought it to the district court's attention in between the government's closing argument.
So it would have been another 9-day trial.
Correct. Your Honor, I completely agree that to the extent that the district court denied the motion for mistrial, that was an abuse of discretion.
Well, and your argument, to put it the other way, is that the steps the judge did take, which were this discussion with Juror Diaz and then the generic, well, sort of laying it on the table almost to the jury in the generic instruction, were ineffective. So I don't think it's your burden to figure out 100 other things that might have been better.
I think that's precisely correct, Your Honor. Those two steps, the interrogation of Juror Diaz and the curative instruction, were plainly insufficient under these facts.
Well, right, which is your position. The government, of course, is saying, look, Judge Cannelli, you know, had a difficult situation. It was the last minute. He responded in a way that he was hopeful would cure it.
And I think that when you take a look at this court's precedent in McClinton and when you take a look at cases outside of this circuit, it's clear that when faced with circumstances like these, to simply inquire of one juror and then give a blanket curative instruction to a panel is not sufficient.
Now, the government argues counsel should have, I won't use the word you, but counsel should have more specifically asked Judge Cannelli to take the kinds of steps you're now saying might have done the job, and he certainly invited on a couple of occasions input from counsel. He said, you know, anybody have any suggestions, whatever, and no one said, how about just an individual voir dire of each juror?
Well, I think as a preliminary point, that to Judge Posner's point earlier, that defense counsel did move for a mistrial, which is precisely the appropriate thing to do in this situation.
Right.
I think to the extent that additional investigation was required, trial counsel, clearly preserved that issue for the record. Defense counsel said on a number of different occasions, at least two, and in particular on page 1030 of the trial transcript, I'm trying to figure out a way, if I could identify that person, the person who wrote the note, and get them off the jury, I would like to proceed, and I'm trying to figure out a way to do that. At that point, trial counsel suggests some sort of handwriting analysis.
Right, but see, it's that next sentence that never comes out of the mouth. You know, it's, and judge, maybe you can just do some more voir dire, you know, or something. You know, and maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe I'm not sure. Clearly preserved, maybe preserved is done, but... It's a little harder to criticize Judge Cannelli for not taking that step if no one ever asked him to.
If I could address that just briefly. Immediately after trial counsel suggests this handwriting analysis, Judge Cannelli responds by saying, I don't think that's necessarily going to be helpful. And then he goes on to say, I've consulted with another colleague. This is what I propose to do. And he lays out the curative instruction. Before there's an opportunity to respond, Judge Cannelli says, does anybody have any other suggestions?
Right.
I don't think I can question. It's all part of the same colloquy. And when he says, I don't think I can question, there are two important points. One is that it's clear that Judge Cannelli understands that what trial counsel wants to do is to interrogate some more jurors or at least get a better sense of what happened here, because he addresses specifically asking other jurors. And the second important point is that he forecloses that opportunity by saying, I don't think I can.
Counsel, how can we possibly say that the result of this proceeding was unfair, since your client gave a very detailed confession after he was convicted and before he was sentenced? And does your client really want a reversal and a retrial, given that all of that post-conviction confession material would likely be admitted against him?
Well, the post-conviction interview obviously postdates what happened here. And so to the extent that the pre-sentencing interview is at issue, which whether or not it is before this court, I think that it also results from the error that occurred here. The no post-trial interview would have been given, of course, had a guilty verdict not obtained. And a guilty verdict would not have obtained had he had an impartial jury. And so I think that the kind of fruit of the poisonous tree there makes it difficult to say that it's harmless because of this post-trial interview, given that the error preceded that interview.
But that interview would be admitted against him in any retrial.
I do think that that's something for the district court to consider, but I do not think it should determine whether or not he's entitled to a new trial, which is a question of his constitutional right.
I understand that. Pardon. So he's still asking, he still wants a reversal and a new trial.
Yes, Your Honor, okay. And I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Frankert. Mr. Bacciu?
May it please the court. First of all, I don't believe that counsel on this appeal really has pursued, and I apologize for my voice, really has pursued the argument that the appropriate course of conduct here should have been a mistrial. The entire tenor of the brief on appeal has been that there should have been some sort of inquiry of the jurors. And I think, as Judge Posner has already suggested, that was going to be a futile effort. What was going to happen if there was an inquiry of those jurors?
Well, except that we don't know. I mean, what she's saying is what he did do wasn't enough. And at this point, under those circumstances, it was error to deny the mistrial. If he had pursued this other avenue and it had turned up evidence, so much the better. It would have strengthened his decision to go forward. If he had pursued the other avenue and still came up dry, maybe the mistrial would have appealed to him more.
Yeah, I don't think that's right in the sense that we know that district court judges have broad discretion when they decide to make inquiries into matters involving juror misconduct. Judge Bauer, for the court in the Reed case, made note of the fact of that wide use of discretion and said that the district court really has a sense of a trial court that no appellate court does. In this situation...
Sense of what? I don't understand that.
Well, in the sense... Well,
certainly, I think the trial judge is obviously in a good position to try to figure something out, although the idea of doing a amateur handwriting analysis sounds pretty dubious. But I think the jury was poisoned, right? Because you have one juror, I mean, it's like, who's writing and the other who's writing, guilty? So you have one juror who's made up his or her mind and has made an, illicit communication to another. And then you have another jury who's received this, I would think, rather intimidating anonymous signal. So we've got two jurors who are no longer really part of the jury. And who knows what this person, the person who wrote guilty obviously has a strong conviction about this defendant's guilt. And if he's willing to communicate with one juror, well, and maybe willing to communicate with the rest of the jury.
Well, there's a lot of food for thought in what you just...
I think what the judge should do in a situation like that is declare a mistrial. But in any event, whatever he can do, he has to do something. He can't just let them stay like that. And the notion that just giving them a general instruction, right? So, look, the way these things work, of course, as you know, is the judge is constantly, from the outset of the trial, telling the jurors they must not discuss the case with anybody, including the other jurors, until, retire to deliberate. So one jury clearly has disapproved that repeated admonition. He's been hearing it for the last 9 days, but he's ignored it. And so he's not going to confess when he's voir dired. So I don't know how you can say he received a fair trial.
Judge, I think he did receive a fair trial. You've given a lot of food for thought there, so I'm going to just try to address a couple of points. First of all, we know from the court's precedents that a curative instruction actually can be satisfactory.
But don't we occasionally have to be realistic and drop these fictions about instructions?
That is true, Judge. But
when we know, when the judge knows that he's dealing with a miscreant juror,
but the judge doesn't know. He doesn't know he's dealing with a miscreant juror.
Of course he is.
He doesn't.
The alternative hypotheses are completely unbelievable.
Why is it unbelievable that a juror
staff, right? That's preposterous.
Why is it unbelievable that the jury notebook could have been used at a prior trial? That's not unbelievable at all.
Well, first, this practice of giving a used book to new jurors, that's one of the most absurd things I've ever heard.
It's a bad idea.
But
putting that
aside,
the word guilty appears on the very next page after her notes.
Well, Judge,
now, wouldn't it be a remarkable coincidence if some previous juror had opened the book at random, written guilty, and just by a marvelous coincidence, that is the page that she comes to, you know, on day nine.
Judge, I don't think it's necessarily the case that we can conclude that a juror actually wrote that note. The district court made findings.
Surely it is much more probable that a juror wrote that note than it was somehow left over from last month.
It's possible, but it's not necessarily the case. One of the other things, Your Honor, isn't...
Well, it's not that it's possible. It's probable. It's not certain. But it's probable.
Well, the other thing to also consider is the
fact
that
it's probable, and no effort was made to determine whether it was true, right?
Judge, there was no additional inquiry.
You can't say something is probable, and now we won't try to find out whether it's true or false. Now, maybe it's impossible to find out whether it's true or false, but then you'd assume it was true because it's more probable than not, right?
Probable that somebody wrote the note, yes, but we don't know when the person wrote the note. We don't know who wrote the note.
Excuse me?
We don't know who wrote
it. Well, the fact that we don't know who wrote the note, that makes it worse. Because if the judge had known who wrote the note, maybe you can somehow, you know, cauterize the rest of the jury against this person. But if you don't know who it is, that means that when they go to deliberate, here's, you know, this person with this firm conviction of guilt.
But how do you know it's a firm conviction of guilt?
Oh, come on. For a juror to write guilty in another juror's book?
On the last day of trial or on the last day of testimony?
Look,
is it the case that people don't form impressions before the trial concludes?
This is an extremely unusual act.
It is unusual, I'll grant you that. But it's certainly not unusual. Certainly, Your Honor, wouldn't
think. It's extremely unusual.
It is unusual, but it would not be unusual
it's
for
crazy.
Jurors.
It's crazy. It's nutty.
But... Judge, it wouldn't be unusual for
I wouldn't want to be tried by a jury that had a guy who goes around writing surreptitiously in other people's notebooks.
But you don't know if it was, again, we don't know if somebody wrote that as a matter of accident or as a deliberate.
Matter of accident. His hand operating under its own motion writes G-U-I-L-T-Y in an accident. He meant to write, I love you.
No, in the sense, Judge, that you don't know if somebody picked up a wrong notebook in the juror room. All the juror rooms are in a stack somewhere in the juror room. Somebody could have picked one up at one point in time. We don't know if somebody else actually wrote the note who wasn't on the jury.
He picks up someone else's notebook. He ruffles through it to find a blank page on which to write guilty, a note to himself. In ruffling through, he fails to notice that it's not his notebook.
Okay, well, moving aside from the point of who wrote it...
How silly can you be, really? I know you want to win your case, but...
Well, here's the thing, Judge. The fact that somebody wrote the word guilty,
Sure, wrote the word guilty.
I don't think it's correct to say that if somebody writes that word, that somehow they're impermissibly tainted. We don't know... there's nothing to suggest in the record that the fact that they wrote that...
Why do you think the person wrote... Assuming another juror wrote guilty, knowing it was... Ms. Diaz's notebook. What do you think he was thinking?
You know, it is possible that what his preliminary assessment of the evidence, given the fact that this is towards the end of the trial when it was discovered, if we accredit Your Honor's view of the facts that it was found on the last page on the last day of trial, that would suggest it was perhaps written, arguably maybe on that day. If that's the case, then perhaps he's expressing a tentative view of what the evidence shows. You talked about not indulging in fictions. Isn't it also a fiction to think that tentative views aren't formed before the jury actually goes back to deliberate?
Of course they're formed.
So
that's
if it's
why.
Not, and in
that's
fact, it's
look,
not.
That's why they're told not to talk to the other jurors, because you don't want the tentative views to crystallize, because you have someone who has a tentative view and announce the view, and the other jurors say, well, this person must know something. He's figured out what's going on.
Well, in this sense, there wasn't really
that's
much.
That's a serious rule. They're not supposed to talk to each other. Of course, it's violated, but it's one thing to have them slip. It's another thing to have this anonymous communication, you know.
But it wasn't much of a communication.
Black spot in Treasure Island or something. You know,
it was only one word.
Serious. Only one word. It would
yes,
be better if it had been 10 words.
Well, if there had been some sort of discussion, this isn't much in the way of premature deliberations, Judge. There's one word here. I mean, if that word had been
the
uttered...
Bottom line, though,
worse,
isn't it?
Worse and worse.
Judge, my view of this is that... if the plain error standard review does apply, there's no way to overcome the idea that there's been a miscarriage of justice here. The defendant has actually admitted.
But there's no plain error standard. There's a motion for a mistrial. The defense is on the record that the events as a whole required a mistrial, and that's the issue before
but
us.
But the defense, at the time the mistrial motion is made, never suggests that a curative
doesn't
instruction.
Doesn't matter. They say everything is spoiled now. We want a mistrial.
But they never actually suggested a curative instruction.
Doesn't matter. They moved for a mistrial and the judge turned them down. That's the issue.
Then the court's precedent in Reed suggests that a curative instruction is satisfactory. There's no way getting around Reed.
But that's the issue. Under these circumstances and these facts, was the curative instruction satisfactory or not?
And
because
it would
the
be.
Motion, this is not plain error review vis-a-vis whether there's a mistrial.
Well, that argument wasn't actually pressed on appeal.
It doesn't.
But, and even if it were, even if plain error wasn't the standard of review, under the court's decision in Reed, the misconduct in Reed was much more pervasive than the misconduct in this case. It's clear that it was much more pervasive. There's no comparison between the conduct in Reed, where people are known to have disregarded the instructions of the trial court, decided that the defendants were guilty, were reading the newspaper, and yet, in that case, a curative instruction was considered to be sufficient to remedy any prejudice. Here, a one-word note. There's a one-word note. And on that basis, a curative instruction is not appropriate. The jury was told in its instructions as well, let me know if anything else has happened. Nothing came forward. There was no other information, no other improper contacts were noted to the trial court judge, even though he asked for them to be disclosed.
Okay, thank you, Judge. Mr. Bottrill. Mr. Frank, Ms. Frankfur, do you have any time? Or?
Do
you have anything further? You can have a minute if you want.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few brief things. First of all, we did preserve the argument regarding mistrial. In fact, our first issue presented on page 3 of our brief is whether the district court abused its discretion in denying a motion for mistrial. I'd also like to address Reed, which the government has highlighted as some case that is precedential for the fact that a curative instruction is sufficient. In Reed, there was evidence of premature deliberation, but there was no evidence of juror bias and juror intimidation, and we have both of those issues at play here. The fact that this note was found by Juror Diaz, the only Hispanic member of the jury, on the day when Mr. Vasquez-Ruiz testifies.
How do you distinguish the Reed case? So Mr. Bacho is right. You know, that was quite a lot of antics there, doing crossword puzzles, all these guys are guilty, and so on. And there the court upheld the curative instruction.
I distinguish it, Your Honor, because Reed addresses only one of the issues that is before this panel. Only premature deliberations are parallel. So there's evidence that there are premature deliberations. But here we have evidence of premature deliberations, juror bias, and juror intimidation. When Juror Diaz finds this note, Mr. Vasquez-Ruiz testified that morning, and the fact that he was Hispanic was an issue for his testimony. The trial transcript evidences that defense counsel asked him, you're Hispanic, your patients are Hispanic, that this lands in Juror Diaz's notebook after that testimony. Evidence is juror bias that cannot be cured by a curative instruction, which is precisely what this court said in McClinton. You need more investigation, and that's what the district court should have done here. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Prunker.